SCP-8605, The Steel Soul, Part 1. Existence is transient, and nothing lasts forever. This is certainly not a lesson that anyone really needs to be taught by an SCP video, but while we might be perpetually aware of this fact, humans have developed countless distractions to divert our attentions away from the impermanence of our station. Every so often, of course, we're hit with the sudden remembrance of this fact, until some other distraction can perhaps pull us once again from pondering it. If this all seems barely philosophical, then it's a good lead-in to SCP-8605, an article connected to SCP-7005 and the Lampeter Network, focusing on the people still working for the failing network in its dying days. As a reminder, Lampeter is a multi-dimensional network of trains and other conveyances designed to move through different timelines, universes, and realities, which has slowly been dying off due to the presence of the Neon God, a deific force spreading endless cities to everything it touches. I'll just note here that this is very much an article that's more akin to a tale, much like SCP-7005 itself. With that, let's take a look. We start with some text from Dr. Simon Kells, one of the primary characters from SCP-7005, and a project lead on studying Lampeter. Can a thing die which has never lived? When I was very young, my parents built a metal jungle gym for me in our backyard. Two swings, a teeter-totter, and a slide, all shiny and new. Painted steel tubes slotted together, blue and white. Seats of white plastic and chains gleaming silver. There was a pattern on the tubes, but I don't remember what it was. I do remember what a vast, solid thing my swing set seemed to be. A pocket world with logic and motion and life all in itself. A discreet but open system of which I could be one part. Years later, when rust had set in and the pattern was irrecoverable, both in fact and in my memory, and the sun had baked the seats until they had cracked, and the chains would never again support a child's weight, and anyway, I had grown so ponderous and inflexible that it had become, by contrast, something fragile out of scale, and our stock of sunny afternoons together had been spent, and my chest grew tight as I saw that once beloved, lifeless thing reduced to so much scrap by age and inattention, and I looked on its remains with a guilt more appropriate to the shell of a dying friend. I realized for the first time just how much this piece of artifice had mattered to me. With what energy those slips from earthly bondage had imbued it. How much of my essence, and that of those I loved, I had invested there. I placed my hand on every fragment, rubbing grit and grime into the ridges of my fingerprints, and I closed my eyes, though the light was too bright, and an orange glow crept through the skin of my lids. And I imagined something entered into me from the depths of every hollow metal heart. I imagined that this aggregate, unmade thing which could not die would yet live on in me, that I was reclaiming what I had unknowingly but willingly given, that when both of us left this patch of yellowing grass which shortly would become a nowhere as a consequence of our parting and departing, something of what we had meant to each other, ride and rider, would be carried on in my breast. I stood in my backyard, a grown adult, and felt a remorse I could never justify to anyone but myself. And even then, only in true darkness, where judgment's eyes are blind, and I silently apologized to an unfeeling oxide wreck. I had never felt so ridiculous in all my life. But I woke this afternoon in a puddle of my own sick, sheltered by blinds drawn against a world resting in the hands of men with hollow breasts, to whom there is no spark in any living thing worth speaking of, worth speaking to, worth saving. And I wondered if it matters where you glimpse the imprimatur of being. whether you see it in the mirror as the overseers do, or in others, as Rosie must. If it's really her updating the files, and not just another cruel joke of the council, or whether, like me, you see it in the places and things which have witnessed us at our happiest, our best, in our most bold and perfect moments. Because isn't simply seeing it enough? I find that I want to see it again, if only once. So I wash away the residue of failure and disgust, the poison that boiled up inside me, boiled over and burned on its way out. I am raw and empty yearning. I will go to where the sun is shining on the glass and steel, and dare it to break my heart again. Because if it still can be broken, then the rust can't have set in too deep. Dr. Simon Kells. We're then given the file for SCP-8605, which has the Archon object class, meaning that the Foundation could theoretically choose to contain it, but they're choosing not to for some reason. 8605 is a set of documents, each identifying themselves as the LNESC Operator's Manual. Each instance pertains to one known component of or system relating to SCP-7005, the Interdimensional Transportation Network, known as Lampeter. Instances periodically appear at the workspaces of Lampeter personnel, updated in new editions with additional and/or altered content. The bulk of this content pertains to the care and maintenance of Lampeter apparatus, the network of which comprises a wide variety of transit technology across thousands of continuous and detached universes. Despite multiple attempts at enhanced surveillance, no instance's arrival at its respective station has ever been witnessed. The instances invariably provide valuable and accurate instruction for Lampeter operators, though their content is by no means restricted to this. Several peculiarities have included references to the Lampeter Non-Euclidean Shipping Company, or LNESC, despite the organization becoming insolvent in 2021. Higher edition numbers, most often associated with older branches of the network, contain increasingly eccentric and frequently irrelevant information presented with the same levels of specificity and gravity elsewhere employed for technical specifications, upkeep, and repair procedures. No author has ever been indicated, and it's infeasible for a single individual to have authored the over 4,000 instances presently known to the Foundation, plus the innumerable other copies that are likely out there. Textual analysis indicates, however, that a single authorial voice pervades throughout. There is also a definite correlation between higher edition numbers and a more erratic, conversational tone, though textual analysis does not suggest any change in the identity of the unknown author. We're provided a comparison between two different editions featuring the same system, the T-Bar Surface Lift in Universe H576, Karkorum Unbroken, providing access for the Lampeter connection to Universe H235, Mercury Shores. The section in the 45th edition reads, Upgrade and Replacement. Improvements in material science may eventually obsolesce wooden T-Bars, which degrade in natural environments and develop stress fractures from impacting the rears of their passengers and moving them uphill. Increasing obesity rates will also be a factor in wear and tear. While steel is impractical as a replacement material due to its weight, redirecting excess load to the cables, which are much more difficult and costly to replace, and which fail only catastrophically, polymers and plastics presently in development are expected to obsolesce organic construction materials in the long term. Every effort should be taken to keep devices servicing a Lampeter connection in tip-top modern condition. Pretty standard stuff, I suppose, whereas the section from the 272nd edition reads, Transcendent Obsolescence. The wooden T-bar is a relic, and relics catalyze awe. Steel chairs soar effortlessly overhead, the literal heights of modernity, and the grounded would-be ascendant awaits instead a rough collision with the past in a state of near-religious trepidation. It touches a nerve which evolved to anticipate the blow of a master's cudgel or the impact of falling rock. In this instant, we are slaves to a crude device, wholly at its mercy. The seats swing free on the approach, unencumbered, and we wonder if once our turn comes round, they might not swing past entirely, leave us quivering but otherwise motionless upon the platform, a figure of both fun and irritation for our peers as we become an obstruction to their own ascents. When the blow finally arrives, it is always vulgar and ill-timed. This is key. We feel badly used, an afterthought, the only piece of this machinery whose presence is not necessary. We feel so superfluous that surely we are bound to slip off and fall, or else we wonder whether it will be possible to shed our companion at the apex of the climb. Has provision been made for our escape? Might we not be shoved back down again? One does not entertain such thoughts about plastic and metal. Polymers are rational, but wood is older than courtesy. Yet though it is often callous, and we will receive our knocks, it is rarely outright cruel. This seat of unreason was once a living thing. It can be negotiated. Though irrational, wood also mediates the modern with the ancient. The forest is forever, and even in rough opposition, life recognizes life. This kinship forestalls a greater terror by far, that of the new and impartial, the detached austerity of perfect artifice. Nothing so old that it was hewn from a tree can hold us in permanent thrall. This fear, though profound, is only a fleeting thing. As the bar raises us without incident, we leave our trepidation far behind and below. We have lost the persistent primal dread of a sharpened stick, which once made the difference between life and death to our forebears. The moment of doubt, the sharp-drawn breath, and the burn of cold in our lungs is an energizing sequence which cannot be replaced. But when it passes, we see the truth in this landscape of cultivated lies. Each blunted pole is an anachronism on the slopes, an oasis of atavism in that most contrived of outdoor spaces. This is the closest that an organized mind can come to the rapture of facing down a slavering beast, and the illusion is only sustained for an instant. But oh, that instant. It will compensate for the stymied catharsis a Lampeter passenger experiences when they mount at last the summit and are robbed of the chance to descend again at speed. The past has passed. The multiverse awaits. Upgrade at your peril. A voyage which sparks no wonder, trading a single sharp shock for the pervasive unease of streamlined steel, is little more than an odd commute. Although the Foundation can't figure out where these manuals are coming from, they do contain knowledge otherwise unavailable due to the destruction of the Elnesk's records in the waning days of its final administration. They have therefore been widely adopted for instructional purposes by both new and established personnel, within and without the Foundation. Discretion is nevertheless advised where content deviates from logical, pertinent guidance, though personnel having long-term association with the Lampeter Network frequently disregard this admonishment. As the Department of Interdimensional Logistics lacks the resources for a comprehensive investigation, no effort has been made to determine the true origins of 8605. We're given another message from Dr. Kells, which reads, "Until today. Because what else am I even here for? They set us up to fail. No, worse. They set us up and forgot. They're indifferent to our success or failure. The Council simply doesn't care. Infinite possibilities in every direction, and they couldn't care less. Something crawls up the tracks, gobbling down the breathing cosmos and spitting out empty Levitt towns and Plan-Voisins, and everything that matters is quite literally on the line, and I've been generously granted the operating budget to do nothing about it but watch. At least I'm doing that much. These files probably haven't graced an overseer's eyes in months. Rosie is gone. Lost to the heart of the most dangerous mystery we've ever faced. We still don't know how to stop it. We probably never will. I could wait out that entropy in sterile safety. I could shut myself in my office, shuffle the paperwork, keep telling everyone who's left to rotate the tires and patch up the punctures. That's what the council expects of me. Probably Rosie would expect no better. But there's one last mystery left to solve, and if this entire enterprise is doomed to decay and ruin, I at least want to know exactly what it is we're losing. I don't know who will be left to say it, but I want them to be able to say that I tried, that at least one person did care, one version of one person wanted to do something, be something better. So if you are reading this, you empty bastards. I'll be back when the circuit loops round, and not a moment sooner. Don't like it? Come and get me. We're provided an interview between Dr. Kells and Anna Vardanyan, station master in Universe B-247, Red Gardens. Kells stands on a high wooden platform overlooking a broad green swath as a herd of antelope graze by a pool of blue water far below. A gale is blowing, and there is a steady roar in the air with an electric hum audible beneath it. Kells looks up to see a suspended monorail in international modern style pulling into the station. The lead carriage stops in front of him, and he climbs aboard, finding the interior to be faded but well kept. A woman stands at the window opposite the door, looking down at the antelope, and she smiles as Kells approaches. The two greet one another as the monorail begins to move at a slow pace. Kells remarks that he's surprised she wanted to meet up here instead of an office, but she replies that she could simply die if moving from one vantage point is so much trouble. Kells laughs, and Vardanyan says that there's a romance to this thing, and she gets carried along with it, figuratively and literally. The monorail rounds a sharp bend, and Kells swallows heavily, causing her to ask him if he's feeling all right. Kells raises a hand and places the other on a stanchion for support, saying that he'll be fine. She suggests that they could stop the train, as there's probably nobody else riding anyway. Kells replies that that wouldn't be very good business, to slip the schedule just because nobody cares. But she argues that just because they aren't here doesn't mean they don't care. If you love something well enough, you can keep away from it indefinitely. She thinks that must be what perfect love is like, and she hopes she never loves anything that well. The two watch as the field gives way to rolling hills, peppered with white flowers. A shaggy predator pursues a pair of antelope, its form too motion-blurred to be properly discerned. Kells asks her what she knows about the operator's manual, and she says only that it doesn't say anything she doesn't already know. Kells replies that surely the technical details are useful at least, but she says that she doesn't count numbers as knowledge. That's just rules, and rules fill the space meant for understanding. You never need both. Kells imagines that she understands this train pretty well, but she says that she understands it less and less every day, comparing it to falling asleep. She reaches out and touches the window, tracing the path of the predator as it downs the first antelope, and a turn in the track removes the scene from view. She then touches her own cheek, leaving a faint imprint of rust on her skin. Kells asks if she's ever seen anything in the manual that struck her as strange, or whimsical, or even inappropriate. A look of guilty pleasure flashes across her face, and she says that she hasn't seen nearly enough, but maybe she's too far gone and it's just regurgitating her faded impressions back to her. She then says that they fail her so much, it's only natural that she fail them right back. Kells asks if she's referring to the train or Lampeter, but she says that it's all the same and touches the window again. He asks her why she's doing that, caressing the glass and steel, and she looks down at her hand in surprise. She says that that's interesting, and maybe she's trying to remind herself that it's still here, or that she is. These things aren't as permanent as they feel. Kells states that this is one of the newer legs of Lampeter, so it's going to outlast either of them, but Vardanian replies that it's already half gone. She walks to the opposite side of the carriage and asks if he has seen the rail, which he hasn't, as it didn't seem important without the train. She asks him if he knows what monorail means, which he does, and then she asks him why that's worthy of note. She explains that loneliness is a human kind of math, the result of subtraction, which he corrects her to mean difference. She says that this train is different now, now and forever. There used to be two lines here, running parallel for a good long stretch, and if you look, you can see the difference down there. Kells looks out the window and down, seeing a few broken pylons and the remains of a track still visible, though overgrown with neon green grass. Kells asks what happened to it, and she says that it's the same thing that's happening to the rest of the system. Kells didn't think it was this bad, so close to home, but she replies that that's just his perspective. In another sense, they're far flung, and the momentum is still in here, still resonating, flying them apart. The wind outside the monorail increases in intensity, whistling in the space between the carriage and the track. Kells attempts to match the pitch with a whistle of his own, then stops, asking her if they can focus on the manual. Vardanian replies that the only parts worth focusing on will come up organically as they talk, little snapshots of the things that matter. She then blinks and repeats the word snapshots, exclaiming that the manual says they should take photographs of everything, outside and inside. Kells asks why, as that seems like something more appropriate for a tourist handbook, wondering what photographs have to do with keeping the line going. She replies that nothing could be more important, and she reaches into her pocket to pull out a creased, faded photograph. It shows a high-windowed perspective on a gully filled with crystalline spires in a variety of hues, with the apparent size and function of city skyscrapers. Fine detail is difficult to discern, but it is possible that humanoid figures cluster at the apex of each spiral, arms extended in greeting. A hand, presumably belonging to the photographer, is pressed to the glass in response. It's a view from the other monorail, and Vardanian says that it keeps her awake at night, because you couldn't take that photograph now, or ever again. Someone was holding a camera and pointing it out the window, one specific window beside a specific seat, and in one specific instant they pulled the trigger and committed that view to posterity. It was an event. They saw something they wanted to remember, experienced interest, curiosity, confusion, or surprise. Maybe just the impulse to make a record because the view was there and they were there. A sense of duty, or the moment, but it was a moment. In some sense, it mattered. They turned off the flash so the glass wouldn't catch it. They framed their subject. There was intentionality. And all of that happened in a point of space which doesn't even culturally exist anymore. You can't go to where that picture was taken and take it again, as it's all gone. They've taken the sky without thinking, without even a whisper of intent. One insufficient digit in a ledger somewhere worlds away, and the heavens fell. That shutterbug had a god's eye view, and we let Olympus crumble. Kells remarks that it's a bit dramatic, but she disagrees. She can't express the drama in a way that does justice. When the other line came down, it took an infinity of vantage points with it. She just showed him the only record of an angle on the universe that she and him can never, ever access in the real world. That was a scene from a time-locked vault. If the people waving back were here today, they'd be staring into space. The gap between what was and is. Kells counters that this line isn't the same as it was before either. The land settles, the rails shift subtly, gravity even pulls our eyes down lower. Vardanian agrees that that's also a nightmare, but it's just easier to ignore. They're not following in anyone's footsteps here, and that's not even starting on the passage of heavenly bodies through the black. Really, we're always treading new ground, second by second, the footprints behind us enshrouded in firmament. Kells says that scientifically maybe, but culturally it's the same track. Vardanian turns and smiles, telling him that there's hope for him yet. She then asks what if she were to kiss him right here and now. Would he still feel the thrill when it crosses this stretch again, or would he understand that he can never go back? What if they had kissed for the very first time on that other track, with the spires below as witnesses? Would they ever be able to look each other in the eyes again, knowing that their old selves were haunting an abstracted stretch of air, hanging, suspended over nothing where a something used to be? If they met that distant audience, how could they tell them, honestly, that they were truly in love, when they saw it consummated in a future oblivion now past? Vardanian then stops, and apologizes for making Kells uncomfortable, but he just says that it was unexpected. He doesn't really have an answer for anything. Vardanian replies that she's thought it through 1,000 times, and doesn't have one either. She then quotes the manual, stating that the landscape should only change to introduce new points of interest, incorporate new sight lines, strengthen the ambience of the site. Human beings orient themselves by landmarks. They pace out their lives from backstage to center and back, counting steps, and their legs remember. When the context is lost, so too is the sense of place. And it's impossible to go anywhere if you don't know where you are. Impossible for anything to be new if what was old has already gone. Kells says that a whole universe is probably cut off from Lampeter, or at least harder to reach now, and here they are talking about old photographs and landmarks. Vardanian says that it's not the same kind of problem, and Kells agrees, stating that it's much worse. Vardanian argues that it's not worse, just different. That universe is still there, while her points in the sky are gone, blown away on the gale. Both inaccessible, but not both extant. Kells supposes that it's a question of priorities, but she doesn't like to have priorities, as moods are more natural. She then runs her hands along her jeans, reaching back as though to remove the photograph, before stopping herself and forcing her hand into a side pocket. Kells says that nothing about Lampeter is natural, but she says that some things are, like decay. It all rots down to its most essential state eventually. Kells asks what she meant a few minutes ago when she said that the ghosts were suspended over nothing. Vardanian explains that the spires went the way of the line that crossed them, and they don't exist anymore. Maybe there was no point in having any of it if nobody could take photographs. She points out the window and says that they're passing what's left of them now. Kells looks out and sees shattered stumps of crystalline spires littering the gully below. The vegetation doesn't grow over them, though the surrounding earth is entirely subsumed in green. It vibrates in the intense breeze from above. The remains of the other monorail can barely be discerned where the land begins to drop. Kells says that he thought the spires were some far-flung thing, but they were here, where the two lines ran parallel. So if they were still here, you could still see them. Vardanian says that you could, but not in the same way. Kells argues that nothing was really lost before the landscape changed, but she says that nothing but context, so everything. Kells says that it's just a slight change in angle, a trick of perspective, but she counters that he's describing reality. She supposes that's what he does, though, and Kells says that the manual does as well, but she thinks that he'll find that what the manual does is altogether different. She thinks that it's better if he finds that angle himself, and maybe he can bring her back a picture when he finds it, assuming it's still out there. Kells says that that's also assuming she's still here, and she touches the window again, saying that she won't be, even if she is. We're then given another excerpt from the 29th edition of the manual, pertaining to an orbital lift in Universe E197, Transhumanist Singularity, which reads, "On aesthetics. The new aches to be clean. It should be scrubbed until raw, scrubbed until flesh would blister, so it gleams in the presence of the sun, the first and truest light. We go naked into the abyss, where the light is naked too. The atmosphere does not bend it, as it no longer bends us, extended from our born by this stark and startling bow. Every accretion is weight, and the goal is perfect weightlessness. The past is filth, and the future is bright. A stark contrast should be maintained between. There is another time, another place for the corruption of sentiment. If we go to the stars, we must not go venal. There is nothing evil there which we do not bring with us." We're then provided another interview, this time between Kells and the station master of that universe, Farrax Nur. Kells is standing at the base of a colossal tower which stretches to the clouds and beyond, with no end in sight. A vast structure stands at the bottom, encircling the steel, and a dozen loading docks are thronged with workers, trucks, and trains unloading cargo. There is a sense of impending completion in the frenzy of their motions. In the far distance, a line of passengers prepare to embark. A man bounds towards Kells from a secondary entrance, waving his hands and smiling widely, calling out to him. The two greet one another, and Nur asks if he's going up the well today, gesturing up at the tower with a flourish. Kells isn't sure what he means, and he says that it's the gravity well, Earth's gravity. This thing goes from 1G to zero in the blink of an eye, assuming it takes you most of a week to blink. Kells replies that that has to be the least efficient ride in all of Lampeter, but Nur says that the Lampeter bit is just an hour on, unless you're going to D473, which is 5 days up. It's faster to take the coaster to C926, then the Marine Railway to C847, then the tram to D192, then the closet in the junked space station in Duluth that opens up on the top of the elevator here. Lot of interchanges, but it still shaves off 3 days. Kells supposes that the elevator is more scenic, though, but Nur isn't so sure, asking him if he's ever seen Duluth. Kells replies that he's seen a Duluth, and Nur leads him to the entrance, where the walls are paneled in a foreign material, like steel but with a web-like structure. He asks to what this humble lamp man owes this visit, and Kells asks if they call him Lamp Man around here. Nur admits that mostly he calls himself that, but he's working on the others. Kells notes that he seems pretty happy with his job as they walk through the cargo offices, where workers on telephones or holding data pads put finishing touches on the manifest for the next trip. Nur says that most people around here only get to take folks into space, so they're all jealous of him. Kells says that the purpose of his visit is the operations manual, leading Nur to pull out a small, rolled-up booklet out of his jacket pocket. Kells remarks that it's just a pamphlet, and Nur explains that they don't maintain the elevator. It's not theirs. They just have a unisex bathroom in the cargo section, a very nice one, and he and Beatrice from the manifest office take turns tidying it. Beatrice is very nice also, but he thinks that she takes smoke breaks in there, so it's probably best not to breathe while in there to avoid cancer. He asks if Kells thought that Lampeter owned a space elevator, and Kells says that no, of course not. Nur muses that it must have given them a real shock when they finished chiseling out that hole in space and found that it opened on space. He shudders to think how many palms the Lampeters had to grease to get that lift built in Ecuador, just so they wouldn't be stuck in empty air, minus the actual air. It makes him smile, though, to think of them reaching down, the ones here reaching up, meeting in the middle, like Adam touching Adam. He thinks that it was Adam Lampeter, and thinks there was an Adam, but Kells interrupts him by slapping his own hand with the pamphlet. Nur blinks and his mouth hangs open as though he has forgotten what he was talking about. Kells asks what's in the pamphlet, and Nur says that for one, it says that it's fine to smoke in the washroom from time to time, as apparently industrial bathrooms that don't smell like smoke smell wrong. Something about how travel needs contrast, but you don't get that naturally by going straight up, so you need to work some in artificially. Smoke on the inside, pristine on the outside. There's a lot in there about keeping the elevator facade scrubbed, and the company indulges them. He thinks that they're afraid of the foundation, though he doesn't see why. It's not like the foundation has a space elevator. And he briefly forgets that he also works for the foundation now, since they took over the Elnesk company. Kells says that maybe the elevator owners don't mind him scrubbing their elevator for free, and Nur had never thought of that. The pamphlet also says that passengers aren't to queue in the loo, and are encouraged to circulate to keep the air moving. They also shouldn't make a fuss, or the regulars will remember them and start asking questions when they disappear. They don't want a repeat of that murder on the Lampeter Express. Kells exclaims, but Nur just moves on, saying that it says that you should be alone at a window when they cross into the stratosphere, to have a moment of reflection on the power of technology. You can't touch a god's face, but it's only polite to look him in the eye as you pass. Personally, all he ever sees is clouds. An alarm then blares out, three times, and Nur says that they should head to the observation deck. The observation deck is a wide arc of windows and a glass floor, through which bare soil can be seen. The room is full of passengers, and it's impossible to tell which might also be riding Lampeter. The elevator rises, and Kells watches the landscape of Ecuador fall slowly away, below and beyond. He bets that this thing blots out the sun on a bad day, and Nur says that the shadow stretches clean to the Galapagos. Kells asks if that's true, and Nur admits that he doesn't know, he's just talking. Kells wonders how much of downtown Quito they had to demolish to build this, and Nur says that it was a lot. He bets that that was probably in the manual, if they put out an early edition, to make sure they demolish something to build the tower. Space elevators are the tops in futurism. Futurism is the crazy wing of modernism, and modernism hates context. Kells remarks that that leads to people hating modernism, which also hates people. Nur comments that that's very funny, but Kells just says that that's why nobody cries when they knock down some old, brutalist building. Nur laughs, and Kells asks him if he thinks that they should. If people should lament environments that are indifferent to them, their wants and needs. Nur says that he thinks they do, and the idea that they don't is what tickled him. Somebody loves everything, and somebody grew up in every environment that's more than a few years old. If it isn't new to you, you don't see it the same. He also doesn't quite agree with Kel's premise either, and tells him to look around the next time he's walking the city, to see how much unmolested modernism he can find. He'll bet that there's not much, and a whole lot more of everything else. When its time was up, it got far worse than it ever gave. Kells says that it's violence paid unto violence, but Nur asks if that only applies to environments built for function rather than form, or does he apply the same criteria to cathedrals and palaces? Kells counters that it's a question of what you want the world to look like, saying that there's a lot more charm to Versailles than Cabrini Green, although he then admits that those are unfortunate examples. Nur says that a better example is that ugly tower they built for the World's Fair a few years back, a great big thing in the middle of a historic district made of bare wrought iron and with its skeleton naked to the open air. It had everyone up in arms when they built it, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone saying anything nice about it at the time. Kells supposes that you can say the same about this elevator, and Nur certainly hopes so, as time heals all wounds, even wounds on the urban skin. Nur hears that that tower is a popular place for photos, though, with lovers kissing in the Champ de Mars, and Kells realizes that he was talking about the Eiffel Tower. Nur apologizes, saying that he knows it wasn't fair, but it was fun, and Kells just chuckles and shakes his head. He asks Nur if he figures that they're standing in the pristine cathedral of Lampeter, and Nur replies that it's something like that. There's a painting of this tower in the Tate, a shining silver beacon in the sky, and he likes to think that all that scrubbing helps. Kells can't imagine why anyone would want to adopt this thing as a symbol, as it's a commercial venture. The people who own it want to colonize outer space, to exploit resources, and get away from the little folks. Nur counters that they outnumber them, and eventually all the big folks die. Maybe all at once, if we're very lucky. There's not enough air up there for people who don't contribute. Someday, as far as his grandchildren are concerned, this tower will always have been here, and it will mean something to them that has nothing to do with profit margins. People buy the myth, not the history. Kells says that that's good, as John Lampeter burned almost all of the Elnesk's history. Nur says that he just burned the parts his family owned, and couldn't touch what belonged to everyone else. Context is king, and the public imaginary is its first and grandest palace. Kells remarks that there's a philosopher hiding in every station master, apparently, and Nur shrugs, saying that the mind broadens and it's an occupational hazard. The windows then suddenly dim, and Nur states that the company guidelines say to look away now. Kells asks what the manual says, as the orb of the sun comes into clear view. Both men wince as they look at it, and Nur remarks that he guessed right. We then get another note from Kells, which reads, "There's a photograph of me as a young child, sitting in a little wooden wagon with red rails, surrounded by all four of my grandparents. I think it's from my christening, which is fun, because that certainly didn't take. I am surrounded, and I am loved. Maybe 10 years later, and that wagon has been pulled around the backyard almost as much as the lawnmower has been pushed. I carry everything with it, even when the thing would be lighter on its own. But I don't go outside as much as I used to, at least not of my own volition. They have to kick me out, because I'd rather sit in front of the lights and make them dance. I think that makes me happier, although the bite marks on my controllers suggest otherwise. Conversely, I've never kicked the wagon in anger. But I'm kicking it today. The bottom has rotted out, because I never remember to put it in the shed when I'm done with it. The red sides are long since gone, so it's just the frame, the bottom, and the metal wheelbase and handle left. The wood in the middle has gone spongy, and I give it a kick, and there is give. My friend asks if he can kick it too. I let him. We kick the bottom out of it, wet splinters everywhere. And then my mother comes out of the house, aghast, and asks me what I'm doing. And I realize. My father makes up a new bottom and paints the whole thing white, like Gandalf after Moria. People have debated for a long time whether this makes it the same wagon or a new one, or something in between. It's an interesting discussion, but I think I know the answer. If it's not still the same wagon I killed, then why do I still remember the look on my mother's face whenever I see it in the shed? That clean white finish gathering dust and rat shit, and the metal no doubt rusting out below where I can't see. Next, we move on to an excerpt from the 487th edition of the manual, from a section pertaining to a passenger locomotive in Universe K086, Iron Marrow. Of honesty. A train does not pretend to be anything else. It is not a drawing room or hotel. It is not an intimate parlor. It is a mass of metal hurtling at inhuman velocity on a road custom tailored to admit no interruption. It is physical potential realized in full. It rumbles, it chatters, it thrums with power unbridled. It must be allowed to do these things. Its messages must be heard. It speaks of a hunger for fuel, of the brutality of speed, of the labors of its drivers and the legions of dead left in its wake. It boasts of mountains laid low and livelihoods made and lost. Not every message is intended for every rider. The unacquainted will absorb the terror, the thrill, and something of the romance. The enthusiast will appreciate the nuance, that which separates each train from its peers, justifying its name. Those whose forebears worked the rails will be attuned to the legacies of Watt, Brunel, and Fleming, and the coal-faced firemen and luggage handlers and conductors who lived what they dreamt and made it possible. If there is iron in your blood, it will sing when the whistle blows. A train's voice is a lullaby, half remembered in the species' substrate from the victorious trauma of civilization's cruelest chapters. Nothing can be done to quell this soothing savagery. Nothing should be attempted. As a follow-up, then, we have an interview between Kells and the station master of that universe, Stephen Goodman. Kells passes through a long carriage filled with mail sacks in neat rows, one of them marked with a stylized L. The door at the end opens on a narrow, exposed walkway, with wind whipping past, and Kells has some difficulty opening the opposite door. The carriage beyond is empty except for a single man sitting by a window, looking out. Kells sits down across from him, and Goodman remarks that it's funny how it all looks bigger from in here, the landscape. You expect it to look like a kid's playset, but all that guff people talk on how rails shrank the world isn't true, far as he can see. Motion magnifies, gives perspective, and things just seem more important at speed. Kells asks if he's the station master, and he says that he's one of them, but he's riding home. Kells asks where he lives, and Goodman laughs, stating that he lives here, but he sleeps in Chicago. He muses that riding a train is not like sitting in your car. When you're stuck out on the freeway, all you can think of is the destination. When you're looking out these windows, though, it doesn't really matter where you're going anymore. Nowhere bound and bound to nowhere. The journey its own destination. You no more consider where the train is going than you consider the orbit of the Earth under your feet. Kells supposes that the manual has a lot to say about looking out the window, and Goodman states that there's a whole damn chapter last he looked, and might be more now. Kells asks him where he thinks it comes from, and Goodman says that he thinks it's where all this goes, tapping his head, and what's in here, thumping his chest. Nowhere else for it to go, except the ether, and he can't believe all that energy just evaporates into nothing. He then shivers, and Kells asks if he's all right. He says that it's just the chills, symptomatic, and it's not going to kill him yet. The iron bones make a powerful difference. Kells still offers condolences, but Goodman tells him not to be sorry, as they've all got their schedules to keep. He asks Kells if he's ever been alone on a train, and he says once or twice, maybe. Goodman says that the first time it happened to him, he was just a boy, right here on the Illinois Central. He can't say how, but he found himself as the sole occupant of a Pullman coach at the edge of dusk and dark. Maybe they were playing cards up front, or down back, and nobody thought to tell the skinny kid with the hungry look. Might be the gleam scared them off, as gamblers don't like risk so much as they claim. Kells asks him what it was like to have the train to himself, and Goodman says that it was like dying. It rolls on, the train, empty or full, and doesn't even notice the difference. A few hundred people barely register to 80 tons of freight. The rods churn and the wheels turn, and the black blur out the window keeps scrolling, and the whistle moans. The train doesn't care, but you do. He sighs and says that if that's how the end is, he won't be afraid. The two of them look out the window together for several minutes, before Goodman says, "They talk of travel between worlds, but an empty train is a traveling world." He then states that he always wanted to be in a crash, surprising Kells. He knows how it sounds, but can there ever be anything so apocalyptic? The first train he ever rode, he was still in short pants, and they were headed for a rail bridge. The other kids told him it was out, but the train kept moving, and he knew that they were going to take the plunge. Burn up or boil at the bottom, with no way to stop it. It's obvious now that they would have stopped the train, but not to a kid. You feel this thing moving beneath your feet, hell for leather. You hear her calling out to everything in her path, crying, keep away. You feel yourself a part of that engine of entropy. That vulnerable moment when everything is possible. You believe it when you hear this is the last ride to that last best terminal. In the moment, it was easier to believe that the world would end than that train ever slow down, all raw speed and danger. Nothing else to her, or to him. Kells asks if the bridge was out, but he says of course it wasn't. They shot over that span like a bat leaving hell, and he held his breath the whole way. Kells imagines that he was relieved, but he was disappointed. You don't come down from a thrill that easy. A train that never crashes is just a journey, but they could have been an event. Sometimes he thinks that's the only proper way to go out of service. He sighs again and says that they just fall apart now, each by each, calling it undignified. A body shouldn't only rot, where nobody knows your name or what you've done. It's like his nightmare's nightmare, this thing the Foundation let happen. The bridges are out, and they're plunging into depths more profound than he ever could have dreamed. He wonders where that goes, all that sorrow. Kells suggests that maybe it goes into the manual too, and Goodman agrees that it might, as it does moan so. As if in response, the train's whistle blows, and Kells remarks that despite the lack of passengers, the train keeps moving. Goodman says that they have to, as it's either burn up or rust out, and the machine doesn't know any other way, nor the railway men. Kells notes that he's seen dignity in rust, but Goodman would wager that he's never had rust in his bones or in his veins, as it agitates. The fact is that nobody sings about trains that live, and songs are what keep them alive. He supposes that's why he still rides, until one of them dies, or both. Either way, the last will be there for the other when it happens, and he says that maybe somebody will write a song about that. It's certainly clear that there's something off about each and every station master on the Lampeter network. Not in a morbid or horrific way necessarily, but more that they are all deeply connected to this dying network, outside of it just being a job. Kells, so far, hasn't really gained much information about where the manuals are coming from, but he's definitely gaining a lot of perspective about the train network and the people involved with it. We'll pick things up with part 2, to see where the journey takes him.